can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Now, the question reads that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is paradise, why do you cry for him? The main answer to this question is that the fact that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is in paradise doesn't mean that it's illogical for us to cry for him. Because for sure these Wahhabis also, they believe in their, books of hadith and narration. When we refer to the verses, when we refer to the narrations in Sunni books, we have so many examples in which we know that, we have a martyr, for example, and the Holy Prophet himself has cried for him. Inshallah, I will mention some examples. Now, the question is that for Hamza, for example, the uncle of the Prophet,
yeah,
the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, himself, he cried for him. And we know that Hamza, alayhi salam, for sure was a martyr and he was in paradise. So why the Holy Prophet cried for him?
Why Lady Fatima, salamullah alayha, went to his grave and cried over him for even years after his martyrdom, till the time that she was martyred.
Inshallah, I will explain about the details for Hamza. Yeah, you're right. So I want to say that, the fact that a person is in paradise doesn't mean that we are not allowed to cry for him. So Hamza is in paradise. So why the Holy Prophet cried for him?
Yeah.
I will bring, inshallah, many examples, because it's a very important topic, about many narrations in Sunni sources which refer to the fact that the Prophet and his companions, which are holy to our Sunni brothers, they have cried for some people who passed away or were martyred.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as I mentioned, the first example is Hamza. He was martyred in the Battle of Uhud. Halabi, in his Sirah, he says, Asiratul Halabiyya, volume 2, page 247, Lamma ra'a an-nabi Hamzata qatilan baka. When the Holy Prophet observed that Hamza has been killed, he cried. فَلَمَّا رَأَى مَا مُثَّلَ بِهِ شَهِقَ. We know that the body of Hamza was mutilated somehow. When the Holy Prophet saw his body being mutilated, then he shahiq, he cried loudly.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Ibn Mas'ud says that we did not see the Holy Prophet crying for any person as he cried for Hamza. And not only that, Ibn Mas'ud continues, he says, ثُمَّ وَقَفَ عَلَى جَنَازَتِهِ وَانْتَحَبَ حَتَّى بَلَغَ بِهِ الْغَاشِيَ. The Holy Prophet cried so loudly that he fainted.
Mm-hmm.
This is the Holy Prophet crying for a person who is for sure in paradise. And then he began, crying, Ya Amma Rasulullah, Ya Hamza, or Uncle of the Rasulullah, or Hamza. This is in the Dakhail al-Uqba, page 181. Now, interestingly, we see that it's been mentioned in many historical sources, mainly by Sunni scholars, that after the Battle of Uhud, we know that a number of Muslims, they were martyred. The Holy Prophet passed by some of the houses of the Ansar, of the helpers, and he saw that the women are crying for their dear ones who were martyred in the Battle of Uhud. Then the Holy Prophet, according to this narration, فَدَرِفَ دَعَيْنَا رَسُولُ اللَّهِ صَلَى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمَ فَبَكَى. The holy eyes of the Prophet were filled with tears, and he cried, and then he said, لَكِنَّ حَمْزَ لَا بَوَاكِيَ لَهُ. As for Hamza, he doesn't have any person to cry for him. Then, according to this narration, Sa'd ibn Ma'ad and Usayd ibn Hudayr, they went to those women, and they told them that you need to cry for Hamza, the uncle of the Prophet, too. It's been mentioned that from that time onward, whenever the women in city of Medina, they wanted to cry for any person, they began to cry for Hamza. So it's one, it was not only 1 year, 2 year.
Mm-hmm.
It was many years. I have some points to, confirm that. For example, Ibn al-Kathir says that up until today, when women, they want to cry for their dear ones, first they cry for Hamza. Ahmad ibn Hanbal narrates that Ibn Umar says that when the Holy Prophet says that there is no one to cry for Hamza, then the Holy Prophet came to know that women are crying for Hamza. Then he says, فَهُنَّ الْيَوْمِ إِذَا يَبْكِينَ يَنْدُبْنَ بِحَمْزَ. Up until today, whenever any person wants to cry for anyone, they begin by crying for Hamza. And the last one that I would like to mention is about, is mentioned by Waqidi, the famous historian. He passed away in 207.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that, فَلَمْ يَزَلْنَ يَبْدَأْنَا بِالنَّدْبِ لِحَمْزَ حَتَّى الْآنِ. Up until today, which is about 200 years.
150 years maybe after the
He passed away in 207. Uhud was in the third after Hijrah. So
almost 200 years.
200 years. So still Waqidi says that up until my time, people cry for Hamza first, then for their dear ones. So it's not a matter of time. This is one case, the fact that the Holy Prophet himself cried for Hamza, and the Muslims, they took it as an example, and they cried for Hamza as well.
Very true.
The second one is Ja'far ibn Abu Talib. You know that in the Battle of Muta, three Muslim commanders were killed, were martyred. The first one was Ja'far ibn Abi Talib. It's been mentioned that when the Holy Prophet came to know that he's been martyred, he went to the house of Ja'far. He called his sons, and then he hugged them, and he began to cry. Asma, the wife of Ja'far, she came to know that something has happened. So she asked the Prophet, have you received any news? And the Holy Prophet said that, yes, they have been martyred. And then Asma began crying. Fatima al-Zahra came, and she began crying. And then the Holy Prophet said, عَلَى مِثْلَ جَعْفَرْ فَلْتَبْكِ الْبَوَاكِ. For a person like Ja'far, those who cry should cry. This has been mentioned in many Sunni sources. Mm-hmm. So again, it is telling the people that, it is the Sunnah, it is the tradition of the Prophet to cry for those people who are martyred. And we know that there are narrations from Prophet about the great status of Hamza in paradise.
Yeah.
So Ja'far is in paradise, but the Holy Prophet says that people should cry for him.
Very
so they are not against each other. The fact that a person is in paradise and other people may mourn for him.
Yeah, very true. And even for those who have not yet been martyred, like Khadija salam Allah, the first lady who accepted Islam, the only Prophet himself started crying over her after her demise. And it was famous that Prophet...
Yeah, it's not limited to martyrdom.
Yeah.
Have different cases
so
for natural death.
Anyone that, for example, Lady Khadija, who was the first person who accepted Islam, and her status among the Muslims and also in the words of the Holy Prophet in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is quite clear for all. So we see that for a person like her, the Holy Prophet cries very deeply. Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for your enlightenment and for your explanations in this regard and different cases that you mentioned from the pieces of history and the dawn of Islam, where a prophet or even other companions start crying over the martyrs of Islam. And this shows and this proves to us that crying and, let's say, mourning over a person who got martyred or even died among the Muslims is not something bad, and it is even something that was recommended by the Holy Prophet. As we have seen, the Prophet says those who cry have to cry over Ja'far. So we see that he recommends the Muslims or those who are the people of crying, the criers, to cry over her, to mourn over him. This is what we are going to learn from the conduct and the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet. What is the Sunnah then? what is the tradition of the Holy Prophet? Is it something that we have actually innovated from our understanding? No, this is the Sunnah which is being mentioned and actually has been found from the books of Hadith and books of narrations. Thank you very much, dear Sheikh, for your explanations and your respected listeners for staying tuned and listening to IRB English Radio, the program entitled as Q&A in Islamic Beliefs. Till our next session, I'll leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Li Ali wa Husayn wa Hasan.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
After liberating the whole province of Al-Bayda from the Saudi-backed groups, Yemen's armed forces began moving toward the eastern region of Shabwa. Bayhan, Ain and Usaylan directorates were captured during the first phase of the operation.
The Yemeni army is making these advances in Shabwa with the support of God, because there is a big difference in what we and the enemy possess in military capabilities. We are fully aware that the enemy does not want peace. They are the ones who launched the aggression against the Yemeni people, and they seek to keep our country weak. Therefore, we will continue to resist until we force the enemy to submit to the will of the Yemeni people and stop its year-long war and siege.
Military experts say the liberated areas have strategic importance as they are overlooking Ataq, the capital of Shabwa governorate, as well as Harib area of Marib, meaning that all supply routes linking Shabwa with Marib will be cut off for the Saudi-backed forces.
These advances come as part of the process of encircling Marib because the Saudi-led coalition did not respond to our peace initiative regarding Marib, and therefore a military operation is necessary to cut the supply routes linking Shabwa with Marib, especially the areas of Baylan, Ain, or Saylan, which the Saudi-backed forces depended on. During the next 24 hours, we may witness more significant developments, especially in the Harib and Abiyana districts in Marib.
Recently, the Yemeni army has captured vast areas in the oil-rich province of Marib from the Saudi-backed forces. This has pushed Yemen's army to upscale its operations and move toward eastern areas to liberate all Yemen's soil from foreign powers.
Yemenis say the army is determined to liberate Yemen's territories from the hands of invaders. They believe that the army has the upper hand and will eventually expel all proxies of the U.S., Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates from the country. Yab Latif al-Washali, Sana.
Far away from their homes, the battle for survival continues for thousands of Rohingya refugees living across India. After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of the world. But in India, they are sometimes called illegal immigrants and threat to national security, which activists describe as a deliberate attempt to target a particular community. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities, but these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis. Based on analysis of the Government Crime Records Agency for 2020, Myanmar nationals accounted for just 2% of the total crimes allegedly committed by foreigners. Analysts say there is no case of terror, rape, or keeping arms against any Rohingya refugee, which belies the government claim of calling them a security threat.
We just want to stay alive. We are no threat to anyone since we are humans and have family too. We are really in a miserable state as a detention and expulsion campaign is going on.
Based on official estimates, some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India. Many refugees I spoke with had almost similar views. They say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, hate campaigns against the community are haunting them. As refugee crises continue to be the biggest challenge facing the world, rights activists say Rohingya community in particular has largely been ignored despite the levels of atrocities it has endured, both at home and as refugees. They say India needs to rethink and redraw its refugee policy regardless of the geostrategic interest and stand by its ethos considering the world as a family. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, the community continues to be neglected and unseen victims of violence. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
In the downtown area of Kashmir's capital city, Srinagar, lies the centuries of traditions and legacy that came to Kashmir via Silk Route from Central Asia. This part of the main city, Srinagar, remains untouched by modernization. Set up on the banks of River Jhelum, the downtown Srinagar is home to many scholars who came to Kashmir along with their disciples to preach Islam. Some seven centuries ago, Mir Sayyid Ali Hamadani came from Iran along with scores of artisans, preachers, scent makers and traditional healers. These men settled around the banks of River Jhelum and taught their specialities to the locals. And to date, these teachings are the source of survival for tens of thousands of people in Srinagar. Let's meet probably the last scent maker of Kashmir, Azizullah Kozgar. Few steps away from the shrine of Shah Hamdan or Mir Sayyid Ali Hamadani, this is an Arkigulab Dukan or rosewater shop. It is a major attraction for tourists and the younger generation. The 65-year-old Kozgar's shop is filled with centuries-old jars, some empty and a few partly filled. Kozgar is the last remaining rosewater maker. This shop carries 400 years of Kashmir's legacy.
For Muslims, rose water has a spiritual as well as religious significance. This shop was set in 1820, and these glass bottle jars and decanters were imported from different parts of the world. We have a collection of other fragrances besides rose water. We have been making herbal medicines, but now people prefer modern science instead of traditional methods.
The Kozgar family has been in the trade for distilling rose water for four centuries, and the entire process is done manually. His customers, however, can't do without his handmade fragrances and herbal syrups.
We have been living here for centuries, and we know the worth of his pure rose water and other products. Besides that, his herbal syrups and ointments have been healing our ailments, whether related to skin or immunity. We use his rose water during special occasions and during the holy month of Ramadan to make special drinks.
Kozgar's rose water is made specifically from Kashmiri roses and has been used for centuries to perfume shrines and mosques since it is believed to be extracted in the best of its form. Azizullah Kozgar has acquired these skills from his forefathers who had traveled here from Turkey some 500 years ago. He says they have kept the secret method rolling from one generation to another, but he fears whether his son will take it or not and wishes that somebody comes forward and takes the legacy ahead. Kozgar says the political uncertainty, lockdowns and lack of people's interest in pure rose water have resulted in falling demand, and these reasons might sooner or later force the closure of his centuries-old business in Srinagar. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
It was the usual glad handing and bon ami for the cameras, but after a 90-minute discussion and photo op, there would have been very little of substance for Boris Johnson to claim as marquee victories for his administration. It was the reluctance of President Joe Biden to guarantee the coveted free trade agreement worth nearly £300 billion a year with London that would have been the most bitter pill to swallow. Britain's exit from the EU and the fallout from the shaky Northern Ireland Protocol has been cited as a major sticking point, though President Biden attempted to downplay the link.
There are two separate issues. On the deal with the UK, that's continued to be discussed. But on the protocols, I feel very strongly about those.
Johnson tried to shrug off suggestions the prospect of a deal were disappearing.
The Biden administration is not doing free trade deals around the world right now, but I've got absolutely every confidence that a great deal is there to be done.
Analysts across the Atlantic are certain both issues are intrinsically linked, but crucially, it also undermines Johnson's Brexit credentials.
A trade deal with the United States is very important for Boris Johnson. That's what he was more or less promising when Britain left the European Union. That's what he was dangling in front of us, that everything was going to be okay. Britain would be an international player signing these trade deals and this and that. The one with America was the most important, and he's not got it. And it puts the relationship between Britain and the United States, the so-called special relationship, in perspective.
It would have been a political triumph for Prime Minister Boris Johnson, returning from a successful visit to the White House and brandishing on the floor of the House the details of a free trade agreement with Washington worth hundreds of billions of pounds. Now Johnson finds himself playing the waiting game and hoping against hope that his EU strategy pays off. Boris Johnson will head back to face his ministers to perhaps sell the idea of the UK joining the existing trade deal that's already up and running between the US, Canada, and Mexico. But for many inside government, and indeed the wider Conservative Party, it may well feel like a backward step. Amina Taylor, London.
As government ministers from the 27-nation EU arrived for a meeting at the European Council building in Brussels on Tuesday, it became apparent very quickly that the bloc is lurching towards a bitter showdown with some of its closest allies.
We see when we look at the Brexit agreements that they are not well implemented, that they are not fully respected. We see it with AUKUS that there were some hidden things, so it's not the best context to have trust between us.
Senior European Commission officials told the EU affairs ministers that Brexit issues relating to Northern Ireland must be sorted out before January 1st. The Commission accuses Britain of breaking its end of the deal.
We need to rebuild the trust. We are ready to do that. We are working very intensely within the Commission. We want to arrive together with our UK partners in the joint solutions.
Outside the meeting, members of workers' unions gathered to warn of further problems for the EU unless poverty and exclusion are addressed.
People are starting to lose hope a bit in the EU project, and I think the Brexit was clearly a sign of that. And I think the recipe to change this is to have a more social Europe.
EU affairs ministers agreed to seek further information on the move by the US, Britain and Australia to scupper a multi-billion euro submarine deal that Paris had with Canberra.
We definitely remain committed to cooperation with our partners on the international stage, but any new alliances that may appear, of course, raise a number of questions.
The controversy surrounding the new US, UK and Australia weapons agreement, known as AUKUS, has been raised with Maurice Payne, the Australian Foreign Minister.
I inquired about the reasons behind the lack of prior consultation on AUKUS and regretted that this alliance excluded European partners.
Officials tell me Borrell did not get a straight answer as to why France and the EU were blindsided. It's clear, however, Canberra was lobbied by Washington and London. At present, it appears diplomacy in the West simply isn't working. Trust between allies is at an all-time low. How this will all play out is anybody's guess. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Yemenis from all walks of life took to the streets of the capital Sana'a to commemorate the revolution that took place on September 21, 2014. Following that revolution, the government of the former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi collapsed.
The 21st September revolution means freedom and independence for us, which prompted 17 countries led by Saudi Arabia to launch a war on Yemen on 26 March 2015. This revolution is a resistance against the Israeli project in the region and a resistance against Saudi Arabia's miscalculations, which is prevalent in our country. So today we are paying the price for our freedom.
Our protest is in response to the call of the leader of the Ansarullah movement, and it is a commemoration of the anniversary of the 21st September revolution, during which Yemenis gained freedom, independence, and sovereignty of their country.
وَيَا مَعْنَ
Protesters said the revolution was triggered by the Yemenis themselves without any foreign intervention as a result of the deterioration of living conditions under the rule of the former president.
This large demonstration is evidence of the growing awareness among the Yemenis of the need to get out of the state of exclusion that prevailed under the rule of the former regime. The 21st September revolution saved Yemenis from external domination, and Yemenis today own their decision. The battles that are taking place today between Yemeni army and the Saudi-backed forces are the result of the Yemenis' exit from Saudi control.
We came out today to announce to the world that the September 21st revolution is the revolution of all free Yemenis, and to affirm our rejection of foreign domination and our boycott of proxies and traitors, whether in Yemen or the rest of the Arab countries.
Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi was backed by Saudi Arabia, that even waged an ongoing war to reinstate him. The Saudi-led war on the country has killed tens of thousands of civilians and displaced millions of others since 2015.
Yemenis say the revolution was aimed at preserving the sovereignty of their country, which was under the control of the US and Saudi proxies. They believe that the Saudi brutal rule on their country is the price for the freedom they have gained. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
The 76th annual session of the United Nations General Assembly kicked off in New York, world leaders discussed a myriad of topics of global concern. This year, like the past few years, the fate of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and anti-Tehran sanctions were among the issues mentioned in the speeches. In his first address to the Assembly as the U.S. President, Joe Biden reiterated his administration's position on the nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA.
The United States remains committed to preventing Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon. We're working with the P5 plus one to engage Iran diplomatically and to seek a return to JCPOA. We're prepared to return to full compliance if Iran does the same.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, who was also speaking for the first time to the UN General Assembly, said Tehran has no trust in U.S. promises and noted that his country will welcome talks that would lead to the complete removal of sanctions against Tehran.
The Islamic Republic considers as useful talks whose ultimate outcome is the lifting of all oppressive sanctions. While decisively defending all its rights and the interests of its people, Iran is keen to have large-scale political and economic cooperation and convergence with the rest of the world.
He slammed the restrictions, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic, as tantamount to crimes against humanity. Elsewhere in his remarks, President Raisi said the time for exercising hegemony and violating the will of nations have long passed.
This year, two scenes made history. One was on January the 6th, when the U.S. Congress was attacked by the people, and two, when the people of Afghanistan were dropped down from the U.S. planes in August. From the capital to Kabul, one clear message was sent to the world. The United States' hegemonic system has no credibility, whether inside or outside the country. What is seen in our region today proves that not only the hegemon and the idea of hegemony, but also the project of imposing westernized identity have failed miserably.
The Iranian president said, pursuing hegemony results in bloodshed, instability, and ultimately defeat and retreat. He noted that the U.S. isn't withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan, but is being ousted. President Raisi's remarks appeared to be setting the tone for the upcoming Vienna talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA, which are due to resume over the next few weeks. Iran says it doesn't want anything beyond its rights, that is, the implementation of international law.
The Taliban has unveiled the name of 17 individuals as the newly appointed high-ranking officials for some ministries and other key governmental bodies, such as the country's Directorate of Atomic Energy. The Taliban claim they have done their best to include a number of well-educated people to the new list of the group's acting cabinet ministers.
The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan keeps trying to appoint more professional
and well-educated people as top government officials in order to offer better service to our nation and strengthen Islamic governance system here.
The Taliban's move to appoint 17 new top government officials comes as the group's leadership had already pledged to establish an inclusive government. However, many here in Afghanistan believe the symbolic presence of some officials on behalf of some ethnic groups does not mean that the Taliban is trying to form an inclusive government.
We are waiting for establishment of a real inclusive government, and Taliban must accept such demand of the nation. This is because we are facing serious challenges such as joblessness and poverty.
In the meantime, the Taliban spokesman says the current government is an interim one and that works are underway to establish an inclusive government. According to the group, the future Afghan government will convince the world to recognize the Taliban-appointed government as the legitimate government of Afghanistan. The Taliban are struggling to form their government, while the resistance front in Panjshir Valley says it will never accept the rule of the Taliban over Afghanistan unless they say yes to the main demands of Afghans, demands such as forming a real inclusive government that does not deprive women and girls of their basic rights and paying respect to social and cultural liberties of people. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
According to the results of parliamentary elections in Russia, United Russia ruling party received a constitutional majority in the State Duma. The Communist Party took the second place, with the Liberal Democratic Party the third one. Then goes Fair Russia and New People. Thus, these five parties overcome the 5% barrier to enter the State Duma. United Russia is promoting President Vladimir Putin's agenda, which is also enshrined in last year's social amendments to the Constitution.
I want to thank all our voters who voted for United Russia and our candidates. This is a great trust and no less great responsibility for us. I also want to thank those who voted for other political parties. We respect your position and the choice you made.
The State Duma is elected in Russia for a five-year term under a mixed system. 225 deputies, according to party lists, another 225 in single-mandate constituencies in one round. The results haven't been without controversy, however. There have been widespread accusations of fraud and misconduct. Throughout the 3 days of voting, many videos shared online appeared to show voters and officials stuffing ballot boxes with multiple voting slips. In Moscow, some opposition figures accused officials of delaying the release of online voting results to give them an opportunity to manipulate. In response, Kremlin hailed the parliamentary elections as open, competitive, and honest.
Voter turnout was notably high, especially on the last day of voting. This election will also be remembered by a large number of candidates.
The team of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny accused the authorities of foul play, declaring all the victories against his candidates they supported as part of a controversial smart voting scheme as falsification. Earlier before the elections, Russia's telecom watchdog demanded the Navalny app be removed from App Store and Google Play based on a ruling by the Russian Prosecutor General's office.
For the first time this year's federal elections in Russia took place over 3 days. This year, election organizers have also introduced electronic voting devices. So far, residents of only seven regions in Russia have been able to vote using these devices. According to the Constitution, the new State Duma should meet on the 30th day following the election day.
But the president has the right to convene the first meeting of the lower house of parliament even earlier than this date. The Russian president has already exercised this right after previous elections. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Florida's version of the American dream, which holds that even people of relatively modest means can aspire to live near the water, depends on a few crucial components: sugar white beaches, soft ocean breezes, and federal flood insurance that is heavily subsidized. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Christopher Favell. The piece is titled "The Cost of Insuring Expensive Waterfront Homes is About to Skyrocket." Florida's version of the American dream, which holds that even people of relatively modest means can aspire to live near the water, depends on a few crucial components: sugar white beaches, soft ocean breezes, and federal flood insurance that is heavily subsidized. But starting on 1st of October, communities in Florida and elsewhere around the country will see those subsidies begin to disappear in a nationwide experiment in trying to adapt to climate change, forcing Americans to pay something closer to the real cost of their flood risk, which is rising as the planet warms. While the program also covers homes around the country, the pain will be most acutely felt in coastal communities throughout the United States. For the first time, the new rates will also take into account the size of a home, so that large houses by the ocean could see an especially big jump in insurance rates. Federal officials say the goal is fairness and also getting homeowners to understand the extent of the risk that they face, and perhaps move to safer ground, reducing the human and financial toll of disasters. Subsidized insurance has been critical for supporting coastal real estate market, said Benjamin Keyes, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Removing that subsidy, he said, is likely to affect where Americans build houses and how much people will pay for them. It's going to require a major rethink about coastal living in the United States. The government's new approach threatens home values, perhaps nowhere as intensely as in Florida, a state which is particularly exposed to rising seas and worsening hurricanes. In some parts of the state, the cost of flood insurance will eventually increase tenfold, according to data obtained by the New York Times. For example, Jennifer Zales, a real estate agent who lives in Tampa, Florida, pays $480 a year for flood insurance. But under the new system, her insurance rate will eventually reach $7,147, according to Jake Holhouse, her insurance agent. And that is prompting lawmakers from both parties to line up to block the new rates, which will be phased in over several years. We're extremely concerned about the administration's decision to proceed, Senator Bob Menendez, a New Jersey Democrat, and eight other senators from both political parties, including the Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, wrote in a letter on Wednesday, 22nd of September, to Deanne Criswell, the administrator of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. Created by Congress in 1968, the National Flood Insurance Program is the primary provider of flood coverage, which often isn't available from private insurers. The program is funded by premiums from policyholders, but can borrow money from the Federal Treasury to cover claims. The average annual premium is $739. Until now, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, which runs the program, has priced flood insurance based largely on whether a home is inside the so-called 100-year floodplain, land expected to flood during a major storm. But that distinction ignores threats like intense rainfall or a property's proximity to water. Many homeowners pay rates that understate their true risk. The result has been a program that subsidizes wealthier coastal residents at the expense of homeowners further inland, who are more often people of color or low income. As climate change makes flooding worse, using tax dollars to underwrite waterfront mansions has become increasingly hard to defend. In 2019, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, said it would instead price flood insurance based on the particular risk facing each individual property, a change the agency called Risk Rating 2.0. After a delay by the Trump administration, the new system takes effect next month for people purchasing flood insurance. For existing customers, rates will rise starting next April. The change has won applause from a grab bag of advocacy groups, including climate resilience experts, environmentalists, the insurance industry, and the budget watchdog group Taxpayers for Common Sense. With a rapidly escalating threat of natural disasters, Risk Rating 2.0 is a much-needed and timely change, said Laura Lightbody of Pew Charitable Trust, which has pushed governments to better respond to climate threats. Higher insurance costs, she said, were a reflection of our new wet reality. The rate hikes around Tampa Bay in Florida are unusual, according to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. Most homeowners will see much smaller increases to their insurance bill, and many will experience a decrease, the first time in the history of the program, the agency said. As for those who may be forced from their homes by rising insurance rates, the agency noted that it has long urged Congress to offer financial help to lower-income residents, a more targeted type of assistance than simply subsidizing policies for most homeowners, regardless of their income. For the first time, our policyholder premiums will be based on their individual risk, said David Morstad, who runs the flood insurance program at FEMA. We pledge to continue to evaluate and make adjustments where and when it's warranted, David Morstad said. Lawmakers have responded to the change with alarm. Last week, 38 members of Congress signed a letter urging House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to block the change. We are concerned about the burden of potential double-digit rate hikes on our constituents by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA's untested pricing methodology, the letter read, calling that burden too much for them to bear. Unlike current climate policy debates, which tend to break along partisan lines, views on flood insurance are less a matter of political ideology than of geography. All but three of the members who signed the House letter represent coastal states, including five Republican lawmakers from Louisiana and all 10 Democratic House members from New Jersey. The letter was signed by 19 Democrats, including some such as Grace Meng and Richie Torres of New York, who in other contexts have stressed the need to address the effects of climate change. Neither Grace Meng or Richie Torres responded to requests for comment. Charlie Crist, the former Republican governor of Florida, who now represents St. Petersburg as a Democrat in the House of Representatives, also signed last week's letter. He rejected the Federal Emergency Management Agency's argument that higher insurance costs would serve to alert people to the risk that they face. "That's one of the most inhumane, callous statements they could possibly make," Charlie Crist said. "We're going to punish you so you know what's going on." In the past, insurance policy has been vulnerable to political pressure. In 2012, Congress rolled back some of the subsidies in the flood insurance program, only to reverse course just 2 years later after voters objected to higher insurance costs. But the growing threat of climate change may make that kind of intervention less successful, said Roy Wright, who ran the flood insurance program until 2018 and now runs the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety. "We cannot hide the truth of this increasing risk," Roy Wright said. "We shouldn't hide it. We should tell people the truth."
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. Through the chaos and the razzle-dazzle and the routine of life, it's very easy to get distracted from our ultimate and original purpose, and from the destination that we have been put on this earth to reach. Sometimes, even if we're not necessarily striving to reach some extent of profound, almost unachievable success, life itself and the constant engagement with material things will distract us from our divine purpose, from our spirituality, from stopping for a moment and being present. Let's listen to a short story regarding the distractions of life and how life sometimes finds the strangest way to draw our attention back to what really matters. And we're going to be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah. Dear friends, salam alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. As usual, we have an interesting story at the beginning of our program. A successful young executive was riding his brand new Jaguar down a neighborhood street when he noticed a kid darting out from between parked cars. He slowed down a little, but as he appeared near it, a brick smashed into his car's door. He slammed on the brakes and drove back to the place where the brick has been thrown. The furious man jumped out of his car and caught the nearest kid shouting, "What was that all about? What the heck did you do to my car? Why did you do it?" The young boy was a little scared but was very polite and apologetic. "I'm sorry, mister, I didn't know what else to do," he pleaded. "I had to throw the brick because no one else would stop for my call to help." With tears rolling down his cheeks, he pointed towards the parked cars and said, "It's my brother. He rolled off the curb and fell off his wheelchair and he's badly hurt. I can lift him up." Sobbing boy asked the man, "Would you please help me get him back into his wheelchair? He's hurt and he's too heavy for me." The young man was moved beyond words and tried to swallow the rapidly swelling lump in his throat. He hurriedly lifted the other kid from the spot and put him back to the wheelchair. He also helped the little kid with his bruises and cuts. When he thought that everything will be okay, he went back to his car. "Thank you, sir, and God bless you," said the grateful kid. The young man was too shaken up for any words, so the man simply watched the little boy pushed the wheelchair-bound brother down the sidewalk. It was a long and a slow ride back home to the man. When he came out of the car, he looked at his dented car door. The damage was noticeable, but he did not bother to repair it. He kept the dent to remind him the message. Do not go through life so fast that someone has to throw a brick at you to get your attention. Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Because one of the most salient qualities of this world is to distract us. وَمَا الْحَيَاةُ الدُّنْيَا إِلَّا لَهُنْ وَلَعِبٌ. As Allah says in the Quran, this life is nothing but, you know, distractions and vain actions and means for entertainment. And that's why it's really important for us to constantly practice awareness and mindfulness and to always be on guard, to keep ourselves conscious of the things that are going on around us. It's very important for us to be careful of not becoming self-centered, not thinking that the world and the universe and all these material means and instruments we see around us have been placed to serve us and us only. Everyone is living their own lives, trying to reach their full potential and benefit from life to its fullest capacity. But if we constantly indulge in the material blessings, actually, that Allah has granted us, without actually taking notice of the origin of these blessings, the purpose we've been blessed with them, what we're supposed to do with them, where is it going to lead us, then sooner or later these blessings will be taken away from us. When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the Holy Quran that if you thank me, I will increase you, it doesn't only mean that I will increase for you your blessings, it also means I will increase your capacity. I will expand you when you are aware, when you are mindful, mindful of where these blessings come from and what you're supposed to do with them. You create in yourself that foundation, that capacity to receive more, and I will give more to you in accordance to that. So regarding the story of the Jaguar driver and the little boy who ended up throwing a brick at him as a cry for help, this could happen a lot in our lives, especially in the case of our loved ones. Through my life, especially through a period where I had the opportunity to work with children, looking back at it now, it was one of the most traumatizing experiences of my life. Not that children are traumatizing, but the factors that comes along with it, working with kids and families is full of drama. I noticed a lot parents who think that what they're doing is for the betterment of their family and, you know, their life quality and to provide their children with a better future. What they neglect, however, is the child's now. Children have no concept whatsoever of abstract things that could or could not occur in the future. Children don't look ahead an hour, 2 hours, 2 days, 4 weeks. You promise a child something and you tell them that I'll give it to you in a week, I'll give it to you in 6 months. That child will lose all motivation to try to achieve that, because for them, time just moves so much slower, and 6 months from now feels like a lifetime. And compared to their life period, lifespan, it really is a lifetime. I, as someone in my late 20s, 6 months seems like nothing. As for a child that's 3 years old, 5 years old, 6 years old, even a teenager, 6 months really feels long and tedious. So my point is that, especially as parents, or even as siblings, or as a spouse, or as a close friend, we sometimes get so distracted in, you know, planning for the future, trying to make things better for them, or, you know, dedicating ourselves to a certain task at hand, whether it's our career, whether it's maintaining the home, whether it's our studies, you know, for those who are students of the seminary, that we lose perspective of what's really important. And then by doing that, we're actually taking that blessing for granted. That blessing could sometimes be our children, our family, our spouse, our loved ones. It could be our health, our youth. And then life ends up throwing a brick at our face and knocking our teeth out just to get us to slow down. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.